Here we go. There we go. Tuesday night Bible study on the Gospel of John. We're going to get started in chapter 6 today. So, you remember in chapter 5, Jesus was again down in Jerusalem, and he was at a feast. The feast was not mentioned. Now, some commentators think it was the feast of Passover, and others don't think so. Actually, at this point, I'm of the mindset that it wasn't, because John mentions Passover 3 times in this gospel. So if that other feast was the Passover, he would have said the Passover feast, but he just said at the feast. And while there, he heals a paralyzed man at the pools of Bethesda, and the Jewish leaders, the Pharisees get all upset. Why was that? He did it on the Sabbath day. And then when he explained himself, he referred to himself as God in a more subtle and vague way. Well, that got him upset too. And then he kind of explained himself, and that was the end of the chapter there. He was pointing to some witnesses that he had. That's the end of 5, and then here begins chapter 6, and there's a period of time that has passed. We don't know exactly how long. But chapter 6, verse 1 starts out, after this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. So, after this, we don't know how much time has passed. But we're going to find out down here in verse 4 that it is a Passover. Passover is mentioned specifically. So, let me make this comment right away, because it's John where we get the timing, of the duration of Jesus' ministries. 3 Passovers are specifically mentioned. And we know he started preaching and teaching before the first Passover that he attended. So if that's the case, and the last Passover is the one where he was crucified. So that would be 2.5 years of ministry. If the feast mentioned in chapter 5 was a Passover, that would be 4 Passovers, which would be 3.5 years. We commonly say, how long did Jesus preach and teach? Was he ministering?
3 years.
3 years. So I guess if you take 2.5 and 3.5 and you average them together, you get 3, right? It doesn't really matter. It was approximately 3 years that Jesus was ministering. And he goes to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. So some time has passed. He's made his way back north to Galilee. I want to call up for you a little picture real quick, because there is a little bit of discrepancy. Let's see if I have... Where is my map? Jerusalem map. No, it's none of those. Holy Land at the time of Jesus. Okay. Can you see this? You can turn the light off a little bit if you need to. So, this is the Sea of Galilee right here. There's a valley that heads out this way, out to the Mediterranean Sea. That's the Megiddo Valley. And then there's a mountainous area all around here. The Sea of Galilee, which is also called the Sea of, what did he say? Tiberias. Here on this map is the Sea of Kinnereth. There is Capernaum, right up here, right at the northern part of the Sea of Galilee. And Magdala is over there. Tiberias is right on the western side over here. So when he goes to the other side, it's commonly thought he goes over here to the northeast corner to Bethsaida. Bethsaida was a small village. It was partway off the Sea of Galilee. And there was more gentle slopes coming up from the Sea of Galilee up towards the mountainous area at a little more distance. So that was right there. The reason I bring this up is because some people also think that he was over here in the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee when he did this upcoming sign or miracle. So there is a dispute as to where it is. Well, in my mind, I kind of explain it this way. We know he fed the 5,000, but he also fed the 4,000, separate occasion. We know he did this twice. Could it have been in two locations? It could have. So does it really matter where it is? No. But being over here by Bethsaida, a gentle slope, a very picturesque area, technically not part of Israel, because it's on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Okay? So that would have then Syria, or in this case, the Tetrarchy of Philip, instead of Galilee. Okay, just to give you a little understanding of the geography there. Does that make sense? Okay. Let me close that map back up. Go back over here. There we go. So he goes to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Now this is interesting because why are they following? Miracles. Signs. John uses the word signs. Remember we talked about that? Signature, signs, signatory, that kind of thing. He's doing signs. He's healing the sick. So are they following him for the right reason, or I should say the best reasons, of wanting to hear more and learn more? Not really. They're following him because, they're following him because they want to have more of their people who are their friends and relatives who are sick healed. They want more miracles. Well, that, frankly, that shows kind of a weak faith. But nevertheless, they are following him. So that's good. One of the reasons Jesus does miracles is to not only proclaim who he is, but because he has compassion on people. All right, so that's why they're following him. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Like I said, it's a more gentle slope in that northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee. So when we think of mountains, and it says this here, Jesus went up on the mountain. When I always hear the word mountain, I think of the Rockies. You know, sharp, jagged on the top, maybe a little snow-capped up there, you know, at the certain times of the year. That's what I think of mountains. That's not what is in Israel. Mountains there, and if you look at some of the pictures, you know, I probably could call one up, but in the interest of time, they slope up, and they go up quite a bit, a couple thousand feet. So to go up over a mountain takes a lot of effort, travel. It's a lot easier to go around if it's flat or in a valley. But they're not like with jagged peaks and snow capped like we might think of in, you know, in the United States, or perhaps in Europe too with the Alps, that kind of thing. They're all pretty much, you can travel them, but it is very difficult because, you know, imagine going up a 30 to 45 degree incline for a mile and a half, 2 miles till you get to the top, and then you gotta go down. Walking downhill can be as tiring as walking uphill, right? So he goes just a little way up the mountain, and he sits down with his disciples, and that is the posture, by the way, him sitting down with his disciples, that is an indicator that he's teaching. So he's teaching them. That's a good thing. Verse 4, now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Notice he's not in Jerusalem for the Passover. This is the only Passover that is mentioned of the three that Jesus is not in Jerusalem. So that's a little bit of a, you know, lax piety on the part of a Jew, not being in Jerusalem for the Passover. So the Passover is at hand. Verse 5, lifting up his eyes and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? So notice Jesus is the one who initiates here. He is the one who starts and asks Philip. Why Philip? I don't know. We know Judas was the one who held the money bag, so it's not like Philip was the one who would go buy the bread from the nearest villages, which would have been a little bit of ways away. But he asks Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. 200 denarii. Anybody remember what a denarius was? How much of a monetary value that was?
Wasn't that day's wage?
1 day's wage for a common laborer. Right. Exactly right. So I'm kind of thinking, let's say...
Philip was born in Bethsaida.
A whole bunch of them were.
Right, but so that could be like why he asked Philip, like, hey, well, yeah, come around here.
Yeah.
What's good?
That's a good observation. Philip was one of the disciples from Bethsaida, so he might have been asking Philip, like, where's the local grocery store? Is it open? Can we go buy some bread? Yeah, good point. Thank you.
RSV says, how are we to buy
buy bread.
Hmm. How are we to buy bread?
Which implies money to well, me.
Yeah, which implies, do we have enough money?
Uh-huh.
You're right. I don't know which word it is in the Greek. I didn't investigate that. That's interesting. No, I didn't think there was, I didn't realize there was a variation in the word there. So 200 denarii, how much is that? Well, just do, pardon?
Half a year's wage.
Yes, half a year's wage, that's what the footnote says, exactly right. And to shortcut it, I did a little mental math with the Wednesday class, and I came up with if a common laborer today earns $15 an hour and works 40 hours a week, or for an 8-hour day, you know, that would be the equivalent of, say, $20,000.
Mm.
Half a year's wage. So if you figure an average kind of worker today might make $40,000 in a year, so that's about right. So imagine saying, $20,000, if we had that right now, Jesus, we couldn't buy enough bread for everybody to have just a little bit.
It's Pulfin.
Pulfin?
Which place? Whence shall we buy bread?
So it's probably where is a better translation than how. Yeah. Which is interesting because the ESV is related to the RSV. They're translated by the same group. So I don't know why they changed it. All right, $20,000. Can't buy enough bread. Well, that's incredible. That's a lot of people, right? One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" You know, the first thought that comes to my mind right here, I have to say, is bravo for that boy's mother. He packed him a lunch. She packed him a lunch. You know, imagine being from a nearby town, Bethsaida or another village, and you say, "Hey, Mom, there's a bunch of people going out to see this rabbi who does healing miracles. You know, his name's Jesus. He's from over there somewhere. Can I go out?" And she says, you know, imagine he's 12 or something. "Yes, but make sure you stay with the neighbors. You got to stay with them. And, you know, you'll be gone all afternoon tracking out there to find him and listen to him. So here's a lunch." And she gives him a sack with 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. Now, that's way more than he would need for one meal. So he's got enough to share. So I'm making up a little bit of this. We don't know that his mother packed him the lunch. Maybe it was him himself, or maybe he happened to have it with him or something. We don't know. But 5 loaves and 2 fish. You know, a typical meal for an average person would just be 1 loaf of bread, and you can think of it either as a big pita bread, or they would have like short sticks of bread, like what we would think of as a French baguette, only half size. So they would be about a foot long, you know, 3 or 4 inches round. That would be a loaf of bread or a big pita bread. That's how they made bread, those two ways, shapes. And one of those loaves would be considered a meal for one person. So this would be like enough for 5 people and 2 fish. The fish was probably smoked or salted. They didn't have refrigeration. And, you know, you smoke a fish, it's hard to get it lit, I know. There's some joke about that, right? You were thinking it, weren't you?
No.
you smoke the fish or you salt it, it'll last for a long time, weeks, right? It won't go bad. So that would be, you know, some protein to go with the bread. Of course, they're right there by the Sea of Galilee, so there's plenty of water to drink. That isn't an issue. Now, it says barley bread, barley loaves. That tells us a little something. The two main grains that they grew were wheat and barley. The wheat was the better one, the more expensive one, the more refined one. I think it could be ground finer, I think. I'm not sure. But it was what was considered the higher class bread. Barley was cheaper. I don't know in the growing if it was quicker to grow or if it grew more per stalk or something, but it was cheaper. It was coarser. So anybody have barley bread ever? How about barley and, you know, like barley soup? Beef barley soup. I've had that. Barley is, it's considered a lesser grain, a less desirable grain. So who would eat barley bread? Poorer people. It was cheaper. Okay? So that tells you a little bit something about this boy and his family, too. They're not well-to-do by any means. 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they for so many? Andrew says. you know, we found one of these boys. There's some one of the people here. This young boy. He has these 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but we can't do anything with that.
What made him look for that? How did he know that boy had that? Jesus was just now asking the question.
Good question. I have no idea. Yeah, for some reason, maybe the disciples started asking amongst the crowd that was closer to them. Hey, do anybody have any food? Was there any food? Or maybe the boy was close enough to the front of the crowd that he heard them talking and he said, well, I have some food here. I'm willing to share it. He does have enough to share. So maybe, again, kind of reading into the mind of this young boy or his family, we don't know, kind of making it up a little bit, but he brought enough to share. And maybe he's thinking, well, if other people brought enough to share, then we can all feed the whole crowd, if everybody has enough to share with their neighbor. I don't know. But yes, why they thought to look for or find somebody that had some food, I have no idea. All right. Then, verse 10, Jesus said, have the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Yes, they counted, they would eyeball or estimate the men, the head of household, so then clearly there would be women and or children or family units with them. So this is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood, I would guesstimate, 10 to 12,000 people. That's a big crowd. People are coming from multiple villages all around. That many people don't live in one village. You could have a few hundred to 1,000 in one village. Not that many. Yeah, Joe?
I'm not trying to play devil's advocate here, but in all those people, nobody else brought food.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's this boy who has food, but nobody else brought food? Like, have you ever heard an explanation for that?
No. I would have to speculate other people did bring food. But maybe they brought enough for themselves, or a couple of loaves of bread just to feed them and their family, or something like that. But there's clearly a lot of people who didn't bring food. So yeah, that's kind of short-sighted on the part of people, isn't it?
I'm not actually questioning the miracle, I'm questioning the lack of foresight of
these
people who were, you know.
You know, people can be kind of short-sighted sometimes. Yeah. Delmer?
No?
Okay. Change your mind. All right. So now here is, I would say, the first translation issue. He says, have the people sit down. That's not what he says. He says, have the people recline. Have the people lie down. And then John, the apostle, recounts for us that there was much grass in this place. Now why is that important? Proper translation. What was the posture for eating in the Middle East then and now? Yeah. They would have low tables. Think of, like in our modern day, what you think of like in Asia, out east. They would have low tables, no chairs. It was too expensive to build chairs. I imagine they knew what a chair was. They knew what thrones were, after all. But to spend the resources on wood to build a chair would be quite expensive. So, they would have cushions around this low table, and they would recline. And you know this from elsewhere in the New Testament and in the Gospels. So they're kind of laying on their side, maybe on an elbow. Some of them might be sitting, what we would say, Indian style. They didn't have Indians, of course.
There were still Indians, they just weren't there.
Yeah, well, very good. So, but they would in some way be sitting on the floor on cushions, somehow reclining, probably laying on a side, on an elbow, eating off the table. Why is this important? That Jesus says, have them recline or lie down on the grass.
They're
same word
served.
There. They were going to be served. And not just served. Remember biblical hospitality, which still exists there today. They are going to be guests at a banquet. That's what Jesus is indicating here. Have the people recline. And look at all the grass. Have them recline on the grass. I am going to feed them. That's what Jesus, by implication, is saying here. Further, there is another connection here. Have the people recline. There is much grass in the place. Okay? Let's go look at another very well-known verse that all of you know very well. the early church fathers absolutely connected on this, the claim it was connected. Psalm 23. Anybody want shoes? There's a shoe advertisement here. I don't know. Somebody maybe was Jerry Cableman looking for shoes while on this laptop?
Or talking about shoes.
Or talking. Yeah, right. Simply talking about it.
Or look at some other things in Psalm 23.
Yeah.
There's definitely feet references.
Yeah, there is. Look at this. Second line. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. And what is the wording that John the Apostle has for us? Jesus says, have them lie down, and there is much green grass. Is there a connection there? Yes. It's not a mistake. John gives us that detail on purpose, because that's pointing to Jesus as the shepherd. And what does the shepherd do? Well, before I go back, he leads me beside still waters. Is that still water right there? Yeah, it's a gorgeous day. They're all this crowd is there. There's no storms happening. There's still water down there, and he's about to feed them. And he tells them to lie down or recline because it's a banquet. He's going to be the host, and they are the guests. Ooh, actually that language has a direct connection to the meaning of this miracle. All right, back to John chapter 6. So there we are in verse 10. Have the people recline, have the people lie down. There was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. Here again, I would dispute the translation again a little bit, because that word distributed, I think, would be better translated as gave. I didn't write down the Greek word in my notes, but I know I did look it up. Because the word would be more obvious, translation would be gave. Now why would that matter? For us as Lutherans, and for, say, Roman Catholics and Orthodox and others that understand rightly, Jesus took the bread, had given thanks, and gave it to them. What does that sound like?
Are we changing how we're doing? We're just going to lay down in the church.
Yeah, you can lay down in the church.
Doken,
that's a gave word.
Frugis, yeah.
Yeah, so, see, I still think it should be better translated gave. So, if yes, it's language of the sacrament of Holy Communion. Absolutely. That's not by accident. Again, John isn't making this up, but he's giving us details that he recalls from this event. So Jesus gave thanks, broke, gave. Well, it doesn't say broke here, so that is a slight difference. And then, also the fish, as much as they wanted. In verse 12, and when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. Ooh, this is interesting. He's telling who to gather up the fragments.
The
disciples. And how many of them are there? 12. So, verse 13. So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. So first of all, 12 is a significant number. Remember, John was also the apostle who wrote Revelation. He's into, he absolutely understands the symbolism of numbers. 12 is a number of completeness. It's the number of the apostles. So each apostle had a basket or found a basket and went around gathering leftovers, and they all filled up their baskets. Now, this is not merely a commentary on Jesus being environmentally correct and not wanting to litter. That's not what this is about. Because what does he say? Gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. Well, here again, that could also be translated so that no one may be lost. Although I do think nothing is a better translation because it's a generic word there. It's not indicative of people. but it could be. Look at how generic that is. That nothing may be lost. Is that referring to the fragments or is that referring to the people? You see? That nothing may be lost. The early church fathers, again, said that this is a precursor to the Lord's Supper. Because what Jesus is doing here, he took the bread, gave thanks, distributed to them, so there's the language of the Lord's Supper, and then he says, gather up the leftovers to whom? The apostles, who are the founders of the church, after Pentecost, that's where the church started, with the apostles preaching. So to the church, he gives the leftovers, so that no one may be lost. The apostles are the church, the first church, the early church. So that they may then, what? Redistribute it to those who are not present at that time. That it comes from this miracle of Jesus. They gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. See, there is absolutely direct connection here between this event and the Lord's Supper. All right? This also reflects John 3:16, so also in this apostle. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. How does he sustain them? Jesus is the host, remember. We are the guests. These people are the guests. He sustains them there, physically, through the bread and the fish. But that bread also sustains us because we partake of that bread when we have the Lord's Supper in Holy Communion. Do you see a connection? It's fairly obvious.
And it's the same word, apolitai, no one lost, so that none, in John 3:16.
Yes.
And in this, none
yes.
should be lost.
Same word.
It's the same word.
Yes.
Should perish. Not
correct.
Perishing.
Correct. Exactly. And how is it, what does Jesus give to you as one of the means to keep you from perishing eternally? He gives you the Lord's Supper. It's one of the means of grace, we say, right? The Lord's Supper delivers to you strength of faith, forgiveness of sins, so that you may not perish. So again, John 3:16 is linked to this event right here, which is also linked to communion. Which is yet to come. Jesus hasn't yet instituted Holy Communion, but this is a precursor to it. All right. Verse 14. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." So what are they referring to that first? First of all, John says sign again. There are 7 signs in the Gospel of John, 7 miracles. Did Jesus do more than that? Yes. But these 7, John points out for specific purposes. This one as well. This is the 4th of those 7 signs. Oh, 4. What position is that within 7? The middle. Remember, in both Hebrew and Greek poetry, the middle line is the theme verse. It's called a chiasm, a chiastic poem. The middle is the theme. This is the middle of the 7 signs. That has some significance. More on that in just a few moments. So, when they saw the sign, why were they following Jesus to begin with?
Signs.
The signs! They wanted to be healed. And now Jesus feeds them. Well, how incredible! This is indeed the prophet, notice it's capitalized, the prophet who is to come into the world. Now, being capitalized, that's a translator's, decision. To capitalize it. But what are they referring to? This is indeed the prophet who is to come. They're referring to the new Moses. In Deuteronomy, which is Moses' final sermon, his swan song before he dies, he says, there will be a prophet after me. When he prophesies and his prophecies come true, follow him. So the people were expecting a new Moses. Of course, Moses was referring to every prophet that followed him, but also in a greater sense, the final prophet who was the Messiah that would follow Moses as well. So Moses is referring to both. So, by saying this is indeed the prophet, this is showing that people think Jesus is the new Moses. He's going to lead them out of the wilderness of being oppressed by the Romans. And while leading them out of the wilderness, what did Moses provide for them? It wasn't Moses, it was God. In the wilderness, what did he give them? Manna! This is a manna event. They have miraculously received bread for sustenance for their bodies from Jesus. They see a direct connection between Moses leading the people in the wilderness and Jesus feeding them right here. So that's why they say this is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. All right. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. So Jesus saw or could sense the crowd, the excitement of the crowd, and their energy wanting to make him king. Why do they want to make him king? Because he could heal people and he could feed them miraculously. Well, why would you want to make such a person a king? But was that the purpose for Jesus to come? No. He knows that. So perceiving that, he kind of slips away again. He does this a lot, doesn't he? Kind of slips through the crowd, just quietly disappears. He goes farther up the mountain, most likely, it says, again to the mountain by himself. So a little bit of solitude. After going through all of this uproar and this excitement and being surrounded by the crowds, remember, 10 to 12,000 people, you think he might want a little solitude? Maybe a little time to pray? How many of you like quiet time? I had to see everybody either raising their hand or smiling. Yeah, we all need a little quiet time from time to time, right?
People in Jerusalem for the Passover.
Pardon?
Why are not these people in Jerusalem?
You know, I wondered that in my head too. I have no idea. All pious Jews should have been in Jerusalem for the Passover. And here you got this huge crowd, and they're not in Jerusalem.
But they're not. Galilee
either. Yeah, technically they're not even in Galilee. They're on the other side.
They might not be Jews.
Well, some of them might not be. That's true. I hadn't thought of that. That's a good point. There would probably be non-Jews mixed into this crowd. So some part of them were Jewish and some part were not. Alright. So Jesus goes up on the mountain by himself. Verse 16. We're going to do this next little event and that's where we'll end. When evening came, so it was already probably late afternoon, like supper time. So evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. So either they already knew that Jesus had established Capernaum as kind of his home base of operations. They knew that. Again, a few of the disciples were from Capernaum. Or Jesus had mentioned, you know, I'm going to go off by myself. I want to have a little quiet time. I'm going to pray. I'll meet you at Capernaum tomorrow. Now, you could walk around the northern side of the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is like 7 miles wide. So if you're going from here to here, you know, you might have a 3, 4, or 5 mile walk, depending on where you are, but you could do it. Or you can sail across. Okay? So, whichever the case may be, they knew they needed to get to Capernaum to meet up with Jesus again. So, they found a boat, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. Now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. Verse 18. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. Now again, when you're there, or if you've seen pictures, there are mountainous areas, highlands, all around the Sea of Galilee. Some of them slope a little more shallow, but a lot of them are more steep. And so a wind or a weather pattern can come across and swoop down and create sudden winds in there, which creates a lot of waves. And it creates a lot of, it's almost like a little mini storm there, rough water. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, and yes, that's a translation into our English distances. I don't remember what's this footnote say? Stadia, 25 or 30 stadia. So when you convert it, it's about 3 or 4 miles. They saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat. And they were frightened. Why would they be frightened? He's walking on water. Can a normal person walk on water? Jesus does this a couple times, and they think he's a ghost. A normal person can't walk on water. Now, I have to tell you, A couple of stories. Well, the one, Jill, the reason you're giving me the stink eye, I'm not going to talk about you trying to walk on the Sea of Galilee. Some of you have seen our pictures when we went to Israel the first time. I show this picture. You get a boat ride across the Sea of Galilee. It's kind of a standard tourist thing to do. And Jill laid down and pretended to sleep in the stern of the boat, and I took her picture. Okay, she fell asleep like Jesus. And then when we get out, you're on the beach, and you can walk down to the edge of the water and touch it. She took her shoes and socks off and stood ankle deep in the water to say she was in the Sea of Galilee. And I took her picture, and I said, here she is trying to walk on water and failing.
Did you do that in Washington, D.C., too?
Yeah. Actually, I have a different story to tell, Jill. I have a different story, actually, I was going to tell, kind of humorous. Growing up, I have an aunt and an uncle and their kids, my cousins. They haven't had an in-ground pool. The kind that's, you know, right flush. There's a sidewalk, and then there's a pool lip, and then, you know, a few inches, and there's the water. We were over at their house a lot in the summer to, you know, as young kids, we could swim over there. We had a great time with our cousins. Well, at one point, and I don't know, I was probably 8 or 10 or 12, somebody among us got these giant inflatable feet from the pool store. So you know what we had to try to do. So we blow these feet up. These things are about this big, and we say, you know, if you can balance just right, stick your feet in the holes, you can walk on water like Jesus. Well, guess what? We all tried it. You think any of us succeeded? That's the stupidest idea ever. You know, you try to inch out there on the water, and whoop, over you go. You don't get but 1 foot, you know, stepped onto the water. It's just, you're like this, and over you go. It's a good thing we didn't fall backwards and hit our head on the sidewalk, you know. Of course, we did dangerous things back in those days, didn't we? Not like kids today, right? They're too safe. They don't even eat sand anymore, right? But I just still remember that. We tried to walk on water with these giant inflatable feet, and it didn't work. Jesus is the only one who can walk on water. And so they saw him walking out to them on the sea, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." Here is the worst translation error of today. There are a few other, you know, issues that I mentioned earlier. I would say the next biggest one was that Jesus said, have them lie down or recline, not sit down. That's not what he said. Here, this is not what he says. He says, I am. Fear not. That's a huge difference, isn't it? That is a shame. Shame on the ESV for not getting it right here. I am. You know what that means, right? I've talked about that already in this Bible study and in other Bible studies as well. What was the name that God gave to Moses in the burning bush? I am. And the Hebrew translation, that in Hebrew is Yahweh. That's what that means. I am. Very profound name. God basically saying, I am everything. I am the source, and I am the sustainer, and I am the protector. I am. And I am the only God. Well, when you translate Yahweh into Greek, you get ego I me. That's the Greek word for it. The Greek words, it's two words. That's what this says. It says, ego I me. Fear not. I am. Jesus is basically proclaiming himself here to his disciples, that he is God. You do not need to be afraid. I am God, and I am here with you. And the proof of it was, he just walked on water. That's the fifth sign, by the way. The fifth miracle that takes place in this gospel. Okay? Then, when they heard his voice, now it's dark, it's nighttime. There might be a little bit of moonlight or starlight, but it's fairly dark, so they can't see him. He's walking on water, they think he's a ghost. He speaks, and now they probably recognize his voice, and he's getting closer, so maybe they start to recognize him. Verse 21, then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. Now, Dr. Weinrich in his commentator, he says, don't read in anything into that word immediately. That would mean, it's not like all of a sudden, boom, there was a miracle and the boat was transported from here to there and they were right at the land. likely what this is a reference to is Jesus got in the boat, and what happened to the wind? Ceased. And the waves? Ceased. So now the rowing they were doing, they rowed just a little bit more, and they made quick headway, and they were right there at the shore. So they got there. Lickety-split, no problem, after Jesus was with them. All right. Now, there's some more commentary I have. That's where we're going to end. That's where I ended with Wednesday class. And then he goes on the second half of this chapter. He explains, I am the bread of life, which relates to both of these signs, by the way. The sign of feeding the 5,000 and walking on the water, both of them. But we'll get to that next time we meet. But in the meantime, I still have some other points to make, to point out. Let me pause a minute. Any questions?
So I would, like the bread thing, the 200, how much did they have?
200 denarii would not buy enough to for everyone to have a little.
It would buy 600 loaves of bread. And so I thought, well, a day's worth of work should buy more than 3 loaves of bread.
I think it did. So if you look that up, you know, that might be true.
If you bought it from a baker, somebody who was making it for you.
I thought a denarius would buy more than 3 loaves of bread. I agree with you. I don't know.
But still, it's hugely expensive then.
Yes.
Because $20,000, if you bought that, which, you know, we kind of did the math, that would buy enough bread for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But it's much more expensive.
In today's money, $20,000, I think, would buy enough bread for everybody, you know, for a crowd of 10,000 to have.
Not even close. Actually.
You can have a bread sandwich. Is there such a thing?
Yeah.
All right. A few points to bring out, and this will kind of wrap us up. First of all of this is taking place during what?
Passover.
Well, it's interesting. What was the Passover all about? What was the purpose of the Passover? What did it do? Celebrated. Their annual Passover celebration was a remembrance of their sleep, their release from slavery in Egypt. Right. And part of that was, what did they have to do in that event that they remember and commemorate in the Passover? Well, they had to slaughter an unblemished lamb, blood on the door, roast the lamb, eat it with your coat on and your belt on because you're going to leave in haste. All of that.
And bread.
Unleavened. And by the way, the Jews apparently, I've never actually been to an actual Passover myself, but apparently some of the bread they use in the Passover is wheat bread and some of it is barley bread. Even today, on purpose. They use both kinds of bread because they had both kinds of bread back then. So there is that connection there. Here, Jesus is feeding 5,000 plus, and the language there is clearly has strong Lord's Supper overtones. And then what happens after the feeding of the 5,000? They go through water. What happened after the Passover?
Water.
They went through the Red Sea. And the original Passover and the flight of the Hebrews from the Egyptians through the Red Sea, that absolutely is intended to be, and the early church realizes this, and so do we today, the sacraments. The Passover is the Lord's Supper, and the flight through the Red Sea is baptism. So too here. I hope you start seeing this, because next time we meet, we're going to talk more about this, especially as Jesus is talking about, I am the bread of life. That's what's coming up. So there's the Lord's Supper and baptism, back to back in these two signs. Okay. Now, the fourth sign, the first of the two that we looked at today, the fourth sign is feeding the 5,000. And it does kind of point to Jesus as the new and greater Moses. Jesus doesn't actually dispute that. Is he the ultimate prophet that Moses pointed the people to? After me, he said, there will be a prophet. Listen to him. He pointed to them. Well, he was pointing to all the prophets, but also to the greatest of the prophets, which ultimately is Jesus. Is Jesus a prophet? Yeah, more than that, but he is a prophet. So, Jesus is the new and greater Moses. And he leads us out of slavery. Slavery to sin. And he feeds us along the way. And he cleanses us in the water of holy baptism. This absolutely is a direct connection, not only to the Passover events, backwards, but also forward to the sacraments of the church and to your life as a Christian. These two events, these two signs, these two miracles. And here's some things that actually wrote down a list from the commentary with Dr. Weinrich. Here are some 6 points that point to these two signs being Jesus as the new and greater Moses who leads us out of slavery to sin. Number one, this all took place during the Passover. Number two, feeding of the 5,000 is called a sign. It's a sign of God's power and provision. It's a sign of Jesus' identity, that Jesus is God. And what does God do for his people? He provides for us. It's appropriate that we give thanks whenever we eat, because it all comes from God. Jesus is providing them. And it's not just that he's providing them a greater sign. He is doing that. But he's also feeding them. He takes care of your lowest, most simplest needs as well as your greater needs. Your simple needs of your body, but also the greater needs of your soul. Jesus does both. Okay, number three. Who is the focus of this feeding of the 5,000 and the focus of the walking on the water? It's Jesus. He's the initiator. He's the doer. He's the host. It's all about Jesus. Number four, the language of a banquet and Jesus as the host. An outdoor banquet. Lie down. Have the people lie down. There is much grass. And I put in my notes Psalm 78. So let's go look at that real quick as part of our conclusion here. Psalm 78, verses 19 and 20. Now Psalm 78 is known to be a messianic psalm. Of course they all are. But a messianic psalm. Psalm 78, verse 19. They spoke against God, saying, "Can God spread a table in the wilderness? He struck the rock so that water gushed out and streams overflowed. Can he also give bread or provide meat for his people?" At the time, people were skeptical here in this psalm, skeptical of God. And yet this is pointing to the future Messiah, who would have streams overflowing and give bread and meat for his people. What did Jesus just do? Provided for the people. Bread and meat, by the way. They had fish and bread. And all the water they wanted, it was right there. So this is indeed a banquet. And one of the signs to in the Jewish mind, one of the signs of the pending messianic era, is that the Messiah would bring plenty. It would be an era of plenty. No one would go wanting. So, actually, I would say that's probably true for us today. Do we have plenty? Yeah, we have so much we gotta stand in line for 15 minutes at Meijer just to check out. You should have seen how full those baskets were. Shopping baskets in front of me that were piled up, mostly with food, but actually there was one guy that was a few in front of me. And he had in his basket a few toys, smaller toys, and then 3 large boxes of giant Nerf guns. The boxes were this big. They didn't fit in the cart. He had them standing on end out of the cart. And I'm thinking, somebody's going to have fun on Christmas Day. I hope he bought some extra ammo for those Nerf guns. So, I think my kids are past the Nerf gun era, aren't we, Jill? No? Never? All of our Nerf guns are in a box down in the basement. I'm not sure that any of the kids know where they are.
Well,
yeah,
you do.
Well, yeah, I do, so I should break them out.
They
can't defend themselves.
After church.
Yeah. After, why not before church?
That's how you can wake them up.
I wonder how far a Nerf dart would shoot in church. Hey, if you were in the balcony, you'd probably get pretty good distance.
Mark could probably reach them.
Yeah? Probably.
Is there a patch on the Nerf guns?
There's a children's sermon in there somewhere.
Yeah, a children's sermon in there. Hey, kids, do you think we can shoot the organist from down here? Pew, pew, pew. Yeah, okay.
Well, you know, if that happens, we'll just load data. Carl's got the big pump action
charge. Does he? Nerf gun? Yeah, all right.
With several, lots of ammo.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, Jill.
So all this talk about Nerf guns, we're back here saying we should have, like, the heck with the kids, we should have an adult's Nerf gun fight here. That'd be fun.
You know, pre-COVID, when we did more with the youth and we had more youth, once a year, we would have a Nerf gun war. I would tell the kids, everybody bring your Nerf guns and realize you're going to lose your own darts. Just count how many you brought with you and take that many home. And I would set up a few barriers in there, some boxes that we could dodge around, and we would have two sides and we'd have a giant Nerf gun war in the gym. So, yeah, it was fun. All right. So point number four. All right, what's going on back there?
I said, I think you missed the point.
You want to have a Nerf gun with that. You can do that.
It's good fellowship.
Yeah. There you go.
Fellowship to shoot each other.
Friendly.
Friendly fellowship.
Friendly fire.
Friendly fire, yeah. So, since I got off track.
Sorry, we're like the kids in the classroom.
Yes, you are. No wonder you're in the back row. Number one of the connections here, it's during the Passover. Number two, the feeding is a sign of God's provision, providing, which he does. Number three is Jesus is the focus. Number four, which is where we got to on this, is that it's the language of an outdoor banquet. Jesus is the host, the people are the guests, we are the guests. Jesus is our host, we are the guests. Number five is the Eucharistic terms. The Lord's Supper terms, Jesus took bread, gave thanks, and gave. The only thing missing is he broke it and gave. That's the only part, really, of the words of institution that's missing. And then the sixth one is 12 baskets of fragments were gathered so that no one may be lost. You could properly translate that word as either nothing or as no one. So that nothing would be lost, so that no one would be lost. And that's representative of pointing to the disciples being the founders of the church who are then going to distribute Jesus' body and blood to his people. Okay, so again, there's some Lord's Supper undertones there. All right, and that brings me to the end of my notes. Yes, Jill?
Something that struck me, I had never thought of that being connected to Psalm 23, but I knew where you were going with that. The idea of Jesus having them recline, and in Psalm 23, thinking about a shepherd would only have his sheep lie down where it's safe. So the idea that they're safe with him, that he's where to find their refuges, and they're safe. I thought that was interesting. And then the other thing was when he's on the water, and he says, fear not. I know there are some times when he's saying things, and there are some times when it's like a proclamation that makes the statement become a fact. So, they're safe, and like he's saying, he's not really saying don't be afraid, he's kind of saying, like, you're no longer afraid, in a way.
Well, I agree.
Like his words, bring the fact.
I agree, and something else which I had not thought of, which your observation now just kind of tipped off in my head. That in both cases, in both of these signs, the people are safe.
Yeah.
Jesus is keeping them safe. So that's part of what you just said.
Yeah.
And that's a great observation, because yes, he has them lie down. You're safe. I'm going to feed you. I'm the host. You're the guest. And then when they're afraid out on the sea, because the waves are getting rocky and the wind is blowing, it's the middle of the night, he says, fear not.
Yeah.
In the act of him speaking, he takes away their fear.
And how that foreshadows sacrament.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's another great point. That's wonderful. All right. Any other comments or thoughts or questions? Now, I will say, when we get to next time we meet, which would be 2 weeks from now, remember, we'll talk about the second half of chapter 6, John chapter 6, which is the very famous I am the bread of life discussion. And it's very controversial. It was back then, and it still is today, including among Lutheran circles. There are some of our Lutheran scholars who say, no, Jesus is not talking about the Lord's Supper. There are others who say, yes, Jesus is talking about the Lord's Supper. Well, frankly, I'll just give you a little tidbit of my conclusion. It doesn't matter. Because Jesus talks about the Lord's Supper in many places. So whether the John chapter 6, when he says, I am the bread of life, if that's not talking about the Lord's Supper, so what? And Jesus is talking in vague terms. You will hear that. So there's some deeper meaning there. What is that deeper meaning? That's what we will pursue and explore next time we meet. What is Jesus talking about when he says, I am the bread of life? And it's quite a good discussion, very philosophical too. So it'll make you think. Well, hopefully we're thinking with this class tonight as well. All right. Any final questions? Comments? Let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good night, and Merry Christmas to all.